Good morning, everybody. This is WTBR's Morning Drive. I am honored and privileged today to have with me, and I mean that very sincerely, these two people have witnessed history, made history, been part of history, and they're Pittsfielders. Former Mayor Evan Dobell and his wife, Kit, they worked in the Jimmy Carter administration and with Mrs. Carter. And kind of as a tribute to President Carter and to kind of like a history course to some other people that weren't around when President and Mrs. Carter were in office, we're going to talk about it. I was just talking with Mrs. Dobell, and I think sometimes some of these new reporters and commentators, this is my opinion. Oh, let me do this. We'll all be in trouble. The views and opinions expressed on this program are and those of my guests. They in no way, represent the Pittsfield School Department, School Committee, Peter Marchetti in the mayor's office, Peter White in the city council, or the person that finally got their bicycle ride in North Street since the snow has been removed. They really, President Carter, I have my own, I'm old enough to remember President Carter and that administration. And I will tell you, my memories are fond of them. So I've only got at least about 200 or 220 questions. So buckle your seatbelt and we'll take off. First and foremost, let me say what a wonderful article in the Berkshire Eagle this morning about the both of you. Very, very wonderful. Thought it was very well written. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it was well written. And it's always fun to see the old pictures.
Yeah. Yes, sometimes it's fun. And I noticed Evan, like me, we had hair. And there it is. How did you get selected for this position to work in the Carter administration? How did that take place?
Well, first, good morning. Good morning, Bill, and good morning to those who are listening or watching. It's always been a privilege, wherever we've been, to have been able to say I was mayor of Pittsfield, and I meant that, and I sincerely meant that when we had our opportunities in Washington. As you may remember, we met the president when he came through Pittsfield as governor of Georgia, as did many other candidates for the Democratic nomination in those year, in that time, whether it be Birch Bayh's son representing him, or Milton Schaap, the governor of Pennsylvania, or Mo Udall, George Wallace, the governor of Alabama. But there was something about Jimmy Carter that was compelling to me. We were in a difficult time coming out of an era of where a president had to resign and Gerald Ford was an acting interim president, that had a sense of character about him. I said in the paper, he never used the word I. He didn't say I did this, I've done that. He was a peanut farmer. He was a ranking officer in the United States Navy submarines for 9 years, then went home and became a peanut farmer to save the business and save the community, all of whom worked for the business almost. And then the other offices that he held, he was a state senator. He was on the school committee. Always progressive. They burned a white cross on his lawn when he was on the school committee. Ran for the state senate, had to go to a court to win because they stuffed the ballot box. Got elected governor and then ran for president. And in running for president, he was talking about his vision. He was never negative. He never denigrated anybody before him. But he always was a positive force. And he listened well, and he knew about me. That was the interesting part. That's not ego. That was just my recognition that he had known that he was coming to the city. He knew I lowered taxes. He knew that I was concerned about these block grants that were being used by other cities just to lower taxes, not to be used for housing and other kinds of things that were they were supposed to be for. And I think the president liked me and liked Kit. And the campaign, after I endorsed him on Martin Luther King's birthday in January of 1976, when I was down in Georgia, took a day off. It was a holiday, and went down. And I think what he saw in me was something that he was looking for, people who were not Washingtonians. In a sense, in that city, we were outsiders. Here we were, we thought we were insiders, but all of a sudden you go, there, you're outsiders.
Yeah.
And he wanted somebody fresh, a fresh look. I got a call when we went to the inauguration from Hamilton Jordan at 7:30 in the morning.
There's a name. Fast. I'm sorry.
Hamilton Jordan was his closest political aide.
Yeah.
He was his interim and then chief of staff. That the president wanted to see me. And I thought, and I think Kit thought too, that he wanted to see me because we were part of his campaign, in the sense that Roseland came to Pittsfield campaigning, and we were just on that list that he was having a celebration that morning. And I knew about it, and I wasn't disappointed that we weren't invited, but I didn't know exactly who was invited. And he said, and I said to him, I said, oh, is this about the people where he stayed at their house, or they went around and met the family? He said, no, he wants to see you first thing 9 a.m. And I walked, it was dark. I got dressed. I went down to the White House, entered the South Gate. They had my name, walked into the entryway, and Hamilton came by. And he said, you look good. I said, oh, thank you. I said, you have a nice new suit, to him, because he was always in jeans. And he said, well, you might have to get a few new suits for what he's going to talk to you about. And so I walked into the Oval Office. The president, as always, came out of his corner office, the private office, into the Oval, which is much more of a ceremonial office or a meeting office. And he sat down and he said, look, he said, Roseland and I care a lot about you and Kit, and we want you to be chief of protocol of the United States, and Kit can work with you in it. And I just looked at him.
Yeah.
And Hamilton told me that you get to be an ambassador and what the salary was. And I said, Mr. President, look, I need to talk to Governor Dukakis. I was Commissioner of Environmental Management, as you remember,
right?
In that administration after being mayor. And he said, what he means is he'll do it, but he's respectful to Governor Dukakis and he has to speak to him. And Carter said, that's great, got up and left. Got up and walked out of the meeting.
Yeah.
And I went over to the State Department, met Secretary then designate Cy Vance, told him about myself because we hadn't met each other, called Kit, said this is going to be a pretty extraordinary adventure for us. And that's how it happened. I think it was an individual who understood that he wanted fresh talent in the White House. And Kit had become, and she can speak for herself, involved in the campaign when I was still mayor, that she was with Karen, who was pregnant at the time, who was their daughter-in-law, married to Chip Carter. And then she was in charge of arrangements in the suite in the hotel during the convention. So she intimately got to know them, and I was able to campaign for them as the first mayor outside of Georgia. And even inside Georgia, it was only the mayor of Savannah, but I was the first mayor of outside of Georgia to endorse him, and of interest, first United States senator to endorse him was Joe Biden.
I did not know that.
So it's an interesting relationship. And Kit should speak for herself, as she can well do, that she had that role working with me in protocol with gifts and other kinds of things in our travels. And then, as you know, she then later became chief of staff to Rosalynn Carter. So, Kit, you can talk about protocol.
I have a whole list of questions for that for Kit about Carter.
But that's how I got chosen. It was somebody he saw on the road. I came down. Remember, I switched parties to support him. He thought that was a risk for me, and it was. But the reality is, at times in politics, you have to take what I consider to be a measured risk. The Republican administration at that time was not being successful for small cities. Sil Conti, my dear friend and a mentor, was very close to Gerry Ford. But I called him and said, look, Sil, this is something I feel I need to do. And I had worked for Ed Brooke as his executive assistant. I had worked with Kit. Both of us worked for John Volpe. But when I was president of the Massachusetts Young Republicans, one of my great presidents of the around the state was none other than the president of the Wellesley Young Republican Club, Hillary Rodham. Later, Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Wow.
We were the Republican Party in those years was a party of progress. With Ed Brooke and Frank Sargent and John Volpe, Leverett Saltonstall and Elliot Richardson. But it was changing fast. It was changing fast and moving away from the center to the right. And the Democratic Party was the party that I felt most comfortable to be part of.
Yeah, I think looking back at my youth, my parents voted Democrat, you know, fireman and nurse right down the line, with one exception, Silvio Conti.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how many, when they got in that voting booth, they, you know, no one know who voted for. My parents were very outspoken about. In fact, as a kid, they had me working for him.
And Sil, as you remember, went the other way in 1948 when he got elected to the state senate. He switched his registration from Democrat to Republican, that allowed him the ability to win. And then in 1958, he became our long-term congressman and ranking member of the Appropriations Committee. He was an extraordinary force of nature and a good guy, and well liked on the Hill.
One quick Sil story. We were at a thing at Mount Tom. He loved Mount Tom. And he had a Patriots signed football in a case of beer. And my son put in for the, or we put in for the football. So he really wanted to win it. Well, this guy won the football, and they drew, and I used Patrick, they drew Patrick's name for the beer. Well, so Sil Conti said, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. Give the kid the football. Give the guy the beer. We still have the football.
That's a good story.
Yeah. Kit, boy, your life, you should write a book. Both of you. What an amazing... I have... Mrs. Rosalynn Carter. Oh, you know, let me just ask. They were a team from day one till she left. I mean, that's how I kind of view my wife.
Well, he and Rosalynn were married for 72 years. Is that right?
Yeah. What a team.
They met on the first day that Rosalynn was born because it was the president's mother, Miss Lillian, who helped when Rosalynn was born. And later she took her then about 3-year-old son over to meet the new baby. So their relationship was lifelong.
Well, Miss Lillian was a nurse, wasn't she, Kit?
Yes, she was a nurse who helped with Rosalynn's birth, and the families were neighbors, so they really did know each other all their lives.
Now, she seemed like such a wonderful person. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the TV, but she both President Carter, this is my, and because this is my opinion, I think they were both really sincere, good people.
Mm-hmm. Very definitely.
That's my read on him. I'm an old cop. I've read a lot of people. I never sensed for one moment that those people were anything but really sincere, good people.
Absolutely.
How was it like working with her?
Well, she was really a lovely, lovely person, but very, she was always very well organized and very knowledgeable about everything that she was doing.
Wow.
And very, a very thoughtful person. But she was, in a lot of ways, she was more political than he was. She would, so many things that he did were actually what other presidents considered second-term issues, you know, getting involved with the Panama Canal, getting yep. involved with the Middle East. These were things that other presidents thought were the right thing, but in terms of expending all their public image on, it was very hard for them to decide to do it in their first term. Lyndon Johnson didn't have a second term.
No.
Richard Nixon had a very brief second term. Gerald Ford didn't have a second term. So Jimmy Carter said, these are first term issues. These are issues that have to be done. And you can't wait for your second term.
Yeah. And Jack Kennedy was
a little more cautious about things, but he absolutely was determined to do the right thing, which was, really the story of his life. He always wanted to go to the Naval Academy and worked very hard to get to the Naval Academy, and then had about a 10-year, very successful career.
Yes.
But when his father was sick with cancer, and he went home and realized the role of his father with the community and the family in terms of their business, and that, you know, the whole community, as I mentioned, was really dependent upon the business that his father had established. And he felt it was the right thing to go home. And Rosalind was very much opposed to that. But because she had this, 10 years of living in New York, in New London, Connecticut, Hawaii, in San Diego, they had seen, she had seen a very wonderful Naval life. But they went home, they lived in public housing when they got there. Their three sons had been born, and they had no resources. Rosalind saw the need. The business needed a bookkeeper, and there was no money to hire a bookkeeper. So she got books about bookkeeping. She taught herself to be a bookkeeper to do the family business work. And I mean, that's it, with three young boys so she was always very, very, she would see what needed to be done, and she would figure out a way of doing it.
President said it was a very quiet trip home from Honolulu to Plains.
Well, New York, they lived in New York. she wouldn't speak to him driving home to Georgia. She was always very clear about that. but it did work out. It was clearly the right decision for both.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And you could see that if you think back in them. And when I said they were a team, they got through that, and they were, in my opinion, you know them a lot more intimately than I do. They were a team. Very much like you, both you and Evan. You're a team. No, you are. You're a team. And, too often today you don't see that anymore. You go this way, I'll go that. And I think the Polish princess and I are a team. So she tells me what to do, and I do it.
It's one of the huge benefits in life. If you can have that kind of relationship.
Yeah.
We can finish each other's sentences pretty easily. We think the same.
We do almost every
subject, and we're always together. It's just it's been like that since 1966. And we were married in 1970. Wow. So
the political campaign in Boston.
You know, one of the things I found fascinating and share with the audience, to get the job in the White House, you had to be able to speed read and speak Spanish.
Those were very much goals of the president. And actually, one of the really wonderful things is when after Evan had accepted the job as chief of protocol, and he met with both of us and talked about how important he thought it was to have it be a position for two people to be involved with. And I mentioned something about languages, and he said, "Rosalind's studying Spanish. Why don't you join the class?" So twice a week, I would go over to the third floor in the residence, the solarium, and an instructor from the State Department came over. And Rosalind already knew Spanish. They actually read the Bible together at night and often in Spanish.
Wow.
But it turned out that the reason she was specifically taking the class was that he had asked her to go to Latin America, to seven countries in Latin America in the spring of 1977. He knew that he wanted to establish better relationships, but he knew that there were so many issues in the world and so many other countries he would need to visit first, that it would be a couple of years before he would be able to spend time traveling to South America. So he asked her to go, and
Rosalind
would help advance her trip and then go with her. And so we did that. And she wasn't there to negotiate. She was there to explain that her husband understood the problems. We studied Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was the National Security Advisor, and had been a long-time professor at Columbia, was a great teacher, and we had a lot of sessions with him before she went. And so she would talk about the issues, the bilateral issues that involved the countries, but she made it clear that she was there to listen, because she would be able to bring back to her husband what they said directly. If they met with someone else representing our country, an ambassador or someone else who was visiting, the head of state wouldn't ever be absolutely sure, that it got directly to the president.
Sure.
But Rosalind made it clear that she would bring back what they had told her. And they were very grateful to have that kind of direct conversation.
It was a very important trip. I mean, it led in many ways to the signing of the Panama Canal treaties.
Yeah.
But the president understood, and as you remember, with the dictators like Pinochet in Chile and Stroessner in Paraguay and the military in Chile and others, there could be real problems in South America that no presidents were ever paying attention to. Central and South America, it was somewhere there, but there was always the Middle East and Africa and South America could become real issues for the United States. We were blessed to have neighbors of Mexico, of Canada. Other countries were surrounded by problems. We had oceans on both sides. They didn't. A lot of those countries were interior. And quite honestly, a lot of those countries took a lot of Nazis after World War II. So by sending Rosalind and Kit on that trip was an effort for him.
He sent Rosalind.
Well, he sent them.
I was happy to be part of the trip and to see that she, when it was announced that she was going to do this, it was a new thing for a first lady to do. First ladies had certainly gone on a lot of international trips.
It was very strategic to the president.
In the conversation was a very new thing. And frankly, everybody was skeptical about it.
Yeah.
How was this going to work? And so there was a lot of, there was very close attention to everything she said and did. And she not only had the official conversations with the heads of state, but she also did typical first lady things of more, you know, social social service things in every country we visited. So she had an extremely busy, complicated schedule. And like I said, we went to 7 different countries. We did it in 9 days, which was quite a whirlwind. But there was never a moment that anybody could criticize.
Wow.
And she did use her Spanish, you know, in her opening remarks when she would arrive, and in conversations with people who came to greet her. As I say, you know, she really showed who she was in a very gracious but extremely intelligent way. And
it was
remarkable.
Yeah, they both were extremely intelligent. I like Evan. Is a quote. I took it out of the Eagle. A statesman who thought seriously about policy. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Perhaps we should refresh people's minds about that.
Well, all the policies that he had, I mean, he was not only a domestic president, and, right. and at the same time, he was a foreign affairs. But as you remember, we're one of the few countries where the head of state and the head of government are the same.
Yeah.
So they have kings and prime ministers. A lot of them have parliamentarian government. We have one person who does it all.
Yeah.
So he had the protocol, if you will, Rosalind went to South America and other opportunities, and we had the responsibilities for heads of state who visited and came, and they came whether it be the Pope or
right.
President of Yugoslavia or whomever it was, and he was focused on the substance of it, but he always was strategic. He had an extraordinarily able cabinet. Who he respected. They were very expert in their fields. They were not
yes.
political. They were not political appointments. Even as ambassadors, I think Jimmy probably appointed less political ambassadors than anybody else. And if he did, it was for a country that was used to that. And they were able business people, if you will, who were supportive of the president. But he didn't fill up those ambassadorships lightly. He even France, which is always something cherished by political donors, he refused to appoint a political person to France. Instead, he kept a foreign service officer who had been a specialist because he needed France in his strategic mind to be a force for him in NATO. So it was interesting, whether it be a strategy or a vision of a strategy. He wanted the Department of Education. It wasn't in the Constitution. It is not in the Constitution, not one word about education.
Right.
If everybody's going to sit at home and say that education is fundamental and the most important thing, well, why isn't it at the cabinet level? And it wasn't. And so he took it out of HEW. And basically that became HHS, Health and Human Services, and education became freestanding on its own. And even when he appointed a woman who was a federal judge in Los Angeles as the first secretary, didn't appoint an educator. He appointed somebody who would have an understanding of what it meant in the world of justice, if you will, to have everybody well-educated. 57% of America doesn't have a high school diploma or less. So it's important that the K-12 and K-14 education is looked at, not just higher education pedigrees. But he created the Department of Energy strategically. He understood that oil was not the way to go, not only for climate change, but it's going to run out eventually.
Right.
He put solar panels on the roof. He strategically thought it was the moral equivalent of war. And he put Jim Schlesinger as the first secretary. In a sense, people thought he was being a moralist when he told them that they ought to keep their houses a little bit cooler, and they ought to be more alert to the facts that there were things coming that he saw. But 30 years later, he was prescient. 30 years after that, people talked about wind power and solar power and all those kinds of things. And I regret that because for a lot of reasons, but I don't think the energy situation we have today, where we desperately need batteries, I think he probably would have had a way to come together with people to have a fast track for batteries. But he did those kinds of things strategically. He also understood unfairness. He appointed more judges of color and women to the federal court system than all the other presidents in the history of this country combined. He did it because it was the right thing to do, and it was not a woke statement. These were all highly skilled, intelligent district attorneys, judges in their own district court judges or judges in their home states. They were significant people who would always be, people would be indifferent to them. But he put them on the federal bench and they were extraordinary. He regrettably never had the opportunity to appoint anybody to the Supreme Court. There were no openings. So that was regrettable.
We're going to have to take a quick break.
He impacted the Supreme Court by appointing Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a judge, which would have applied to be eligible to be on the Supreme Court, which President Clinton did. So many of the things that a president does that don't get attention at the time turn out to be important in the future.
Bill wants to take a break.
We got to take a break or they'll yell at me. Well, they yell at me anyhow, so it doesn't make any I'm trying to confuse myself. There's so much meat and potatoes here. This is a great interview. For those people just tuning in, Kit and Evan Dobell, they served in the Carter administration, and they are – Evan was the mayor of the city of Pittsfield and has done so many things. They are a wonderful couple. I'm going to refer to them for this program as the dynamic duo. We'll be right back. This is WTBR 89.7 FM on your radio dial, PCTV channel 1301. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Lots more to find out about the Carter administration and the Dobells.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio. 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield. 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
Missed an episode of your favorite show? Have no fear, because we have podcasts. Type in WTBRFM.com/podcast on your favorite browser and search for your favorite show. It's that simple.
We all know WTBR is great to listen to on 89.7 FM, but did you know that you can listen to WTBR just about anywhere? We've got a web stream, and it's easy to use. Go to WTBRFM.com on your computer and click play. You can use the TuneIn app on your smartphone and connect it to your car's sound system. Or you can use your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play WTBRFM, and there's your community radio station. WTBR, for the love of radio.
Some news outlets tell you what to believe, and they limit your access to the whole story. Some of them are just plain ugly and mean. Social media is filled with rumors, misinformation, personal attacks. Where locally can you get the whole story, unfiltered, so that you can make informed decisions at the ballot box? There's really only one place. It's on PCTV. On cable, on the PCTV Select app, and at PittsfieldTV.org. The whole story since 1986. PCTV. See it all and decide for yourself.
Join us for Up on Taconic, a weekly show that explores the world of Taconic High School from students, staff, school programs, and all of the great things that happen here each day. Explore the world with conversations including the culinary arts and other CTE programs. Hear students and teachers discuss the importance of reading and also take a look at the vibrant arts culture in the school and much, much more. Join us every Monday at 6 p.m. for these lively discussions right here on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. BCC provides access to higher education to everyone in Berkshire County and beyond, offering more than 50 high-quality programs, small class sizes, and an affordable education to help their students of all ages achieve their dreams. At BCC, their middle name is Community. And UCP of Western Mass. Turn passion into purpose when you apply at UCP of Western Mass, now offering full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. It's more than just a job, it's our identity. Apply today at ucpwma.org/jobs.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
And now back to the Morning Drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
All right, we're back. I am here with Kit and Evan Dobell, Pittsfielders. Evan, for those people who don't remember, Evan was the mayor of the city of Pittsfield. Then Evan went on with Kit to be part of the Jimmy Carter administration, chief of protocol initially, and then Kit went on to be executive chief of staff for Rosalind Carter. I get it straight. Don't worry. It's I didn't get my nap in. So, but what was it like? I can only imagine. What was it like the 13 days that President Carter and they were negotiating the Accords, the Camp David Accords?
That's all Kit, not me.
Well, as chief of protocol during that period, I was involved with the arrangements for Camp David. We had the Israeli delegation, the Egyptian delegation, yep. American delegation all staying there together, and there was absolutely no communication. It would be much more impossible to do that today with, you know, the cell phones and all kinds of devices, but everybody who came agreed that they would not talk to the press. Jody Powell, the press secretary, had a location about a mile away from Camp David where the national press, you know, got briefings from him and any kind of updates. But it was one of the secrets that of the success, I think, was that it was very, very private. President Carter's idea was to meet with Begin and Sadat and help them come to some kinds of agreements. But after the first couple of days, he realized that wasn't working. They would become very angry with each other. So he started meeting with them individually. He would go to one and try to work out, you know, some kinds of something that could be successful. And then he would go to the other and sit with them. In putting together the arrangements for Camp David, we understood, because it was a three-party activity, that we needed a round table. We learned that from the Paris Peace Talks.
Good.
And the only large table at Camp David is in a rectangular. It was a rectangular table, a large table in a rectangular room. So that was going to work. So we put actually a large round board on a billiard table and covered it with cloth. And that was the table where the three delegations were to meet together. In the 13 days, the three delegations never met. The individual delegations used the table, but there was no meeting of all of the various principals. It was President Carter individually working with two principals, Begin and Sadat. And things were not going well, but after a week, President Carter had not set a time for how long this would last. Nobody thought that it would last as long as it did. But after the first week, he took everybody
Gettysburg.
Gettysburg, the battlefield. And that was an amazing time because we had all these military people from the three countries. And they were all very familiar with it. They'd studied all of them at Gettysburg. And so it was a very emotional trip. And it really, you know, the idea was it was to show how what happens if you don't have peace, you know, how devastating that is. Yeah. And then after that, the conversations continued, and it was the 13th day. It was a Sunday. I actually had left Camp David. Rosalind had called me early in the morning that there was a concert had been scheduled at the White House, one of the PBS concerts. Rostropovich was playing there, had been established. So she was going back to host that event, and she asked if I would invite Mrs. Bacon be there. Mrs. Sadat didn't come to, she wasn't at Camp David. Of course, I would have invited her as well. So we went back, but there was no indication that the talks would be over that day, but it turned out that afternoon, Prime Minister Begin became very discouraged and felt that he really needed to leave the conference and that it would be over as, you know, not being successful. President Carter went back to his lodge in his office, and on the desk were a picture that had been taken of the three leaders when they first arrived at Camp David in front of the president's cottage. And that picture was duplicated, and the three leaders signed. I have a copy of it. All there had copies. But Prime Minister Begin had asked for copies for his grandchildren. And President Carter had found the names of the grandchildren, the individual names. They were inscribed to each child, and he signed them for Prime Minister Begin. And he took them over to Prime Minister Begin's cottage. And since he was leaving, Prime Minister Begin looked at the photographs, realized he'd have to go home and explain to his grandchildren why it wasn't successful.
Wow.
Became very emotional, and he said, let's look at it again. And within half an hour, they had, you know, an agreement. It was that's the fascinating thing about history, is that, you know, very simple things can change things. So we were back. Rosalind was back at the White House, and we got the phone call that they were coming back, and there was a thunder and lightning storm, so they couldn't use the helicopters. They had to delay, but they finally came back, and they signed a preliminary agreement.
Oh, good.
They were more visits from the principals and President Carter. We went to Egypt and to Israel to do more negotiations, and then finally there was the signing the following March. So it was it was really amazing to be part of. Because the other members of the delegations, they were very obviously very active within their own delegation, but because they weren't, you know, sort of general meetings, there was a fair amount of free time. and in Camp David is a lovely place to walk, but not a lot of activity. So we actually, there were movies. They hadn't been planned as movies for the delegates to watch because nobody thought that. But the Carters went to Camp David often, and the staff that went with them, they would sort of ask for movies to be there so there was something for them to do at night.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And one of the movies by chance that happened to be on this list, and this was a day of a time of projectors. There were three different places at Camp David where a projector could be set up at a screen and you could watch a movie. But by chance, one of the movies on the list was Patton. Oh. So one of my favorite times at Camp David was the night when we watched Patton. And the word spread that we were watching Patton, and the Israelis and Egyptian military people came, and most everybody had military background in the three delegations. And that was a part of, you know, the filming of that was in a part of the world that they were all very familiar with.
Yeah.
And it was something that they could enjoy together because they were very interested in the movie, but it wasn't something that there was any, they had any reason to disagree about.
So,
that's one of my memories of.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add something, Bill, is because yeah. I know people don't, they hear Camp David a lot. They don't know Camp David is a retreat the presidents use.
Right.
It's named after David Eisenhower, the President Eisenhower named it. But if we're in Pittsfield today and it was the White House, Camp David would be somewhere near a mountaintop in Worcester.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So understand it was not next door. And it was a sort of a high-end Camp Russell.
No. Oh. Well, I can say that I share Camp David, Camp Russell. I was at Camp Russell.
Well, there you go.
There we go.
I wasn't allowed to stay overnight, so I went to Camp Sumner at the YMCA.
Oh, see, there you go. Yeah.
Sold soap to pay for it.
Yeah. The listening to that, though, brings back the memory of my own father, who said what a big deal that was. I remember sitting in his chair, watching Walter Cronkite or one of them, and saying, this is a big deal. This is peace in the Middle East. I mean, he was excited about it. You
well,
know?
It was an enormous success. An enormous success, and the Nobel Prizes went to Begin and Sadat. I mean, who literally risked their life, and as you remember,
yes.
Several years later,
because of it,
Sadat was assassinated in Egypt, in Cairo himself. Yep. So, and Begin died a number of years later. But it was a significant accomplishment. And we had a large ceremony at the White House. Kit helped organize, I think we had 1,000 people in tents,
wow.
huge circus-sized tents on the South Lawn. But it was a very emotional time for the president. But it wasn't his only large success. I mean, the Panama Canal treaties with Torrijos was... hugely significant. Kit's been to the Panama Canal. I went down there. You saw the Panama Canal zone, which we were having a military presence. Green, manicured, beautiful across the street. Terrible, third world. We needed to make a decision that the Panama Canal was sort of a situation that Teddy Roosevelt and others kind of helped take it over and helped construct it, but without any real conversations or negotiations, and they would collect gold from people who used it, the countries who used it, and then paid their employees in silver. It just wasn't right, and it was going to lead to another Vietnam. There's no question in my mind. All you had to do is sink one. If you sank one ship, Panama Canal was done. Couldn't move. Very important. Again, the strategies were such that he did so many other things, Bill. I mean, he doubled the National Park Service. Doubled
yeah.
it. Just with the Alaskan lands deal, because America was becoming so urbanized that people didn't have those parks to go to wherever they were in the world, and the ability to deregulate the airlines. If you're taking a JetBlue flight this week over New Year's or a Spirit flight, thank Jimmy Carter. He deregulated the airlines. If the trucks that are moving things around the country, the Amazon trucks are making deliveries for you. Thank Jimmy Carter. He deregulated the trucking industry. The ability of the president to be prescient, to be visionary, was something that was beyond the normal workings of Washington. Usually he made two or three decisions, raise taxes, lower taxes, maybe try to do something with Social Security. There was no new ideas. There was no creativity. And President Carter was a serious public official. Yeah. He wasn't a moralist, but he was a person who would just say things straight talk. And he also took the high road. And I've always tried to follow that legacy. I always take the high road. When you criticize, are you going to lower yourself and get engaged in a conversation that's unnecessary, or aren't you? There was a story that Donald Trump had a phone call that Carter wanted to talk to him, and Trump himself had said that he had thought this is going to be unusual. He's going to yell at me because, you know, I've trashed him all over the country, saying he's the worst president in the history of the country. So President Carter shows up and they sit down and he says, I'm all about trying to save people around the world with the Carter Center and eliminate guinea worms and river blindness in Africa. And I need you to make a large donation. And Trump said he all of a sudden realized why Jimmy Carter got elected president. Yeah. He was resilient. He had no interest in. You want to criticize him? Criticize him. But he's not going to engage in something that becomes a sideshow. And we have too much of that today. And the journalism today, with the undermining of social media, with all the Twitters and the X's and the TikToks and things, we didn't have that. It was difficult enough. We'd be upset if New York Times editorialized something. Yeah. Now, my God, you have people who actually believe something totally untrue, and they take it. I worry about where the country can be headed when no one knows where to go to get the truth. And I must say. It's not because they wrote a nice story about Kit and I yesterday. I congratulate people like Fred Rutberg, who became the publisher, and Kevin Moran is the editor, and the young journalists that they have. The Berkshire Eagle is a rarity. You may disagree with it once in a while, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But their balance is not like other people have balance in where they get their news. And it's real complicated. And social media is a very complicated situation. It may have helped Jimmy Carter in some ways, maybe it didn't, but we weren't in that space. There was no CNN, there was no internet. It was a different kind of world. Three major networks, Huntley Brinkley, Cronkite, Peter Jennings, Jack Chancellor, Frank McGee, different kinds of people.
Yeah, and back then, just to let you know too, I was my father's remote. Billy, put that on channel 6. Okay, Dad.
WRGB.
WRGB. Tatro. Ernie Tatro.
Ernie Tatro. He's on for 40 years.
There's a name.
And Howard Tupper doing the weather.
And how about our own George Bulgarelli? Come on. He didn't miss as much as these guys do. He looked out the window.
Remember Howard Tupper I always liked to watch the news because he would say, "Hiya, small fry." Do you remember remember him doing that?
Yeah.
But that was we didn't get Springfield. I don't dislike the Red Sox, but I like the Mets and the Yankees and the Dodgers because that's all I got. We didn't get
Giants television. Football.
Yeah. We didn't get any of that. So it was just it was a different era, totally different era. This one is with money in politics now being said by the Supreme Court that it's free speech, and you can have political action committees where billions of dollars of money goes, dark money, that nobody knows where it comes from or who's doing it. There are serious issues in front of us, and I'm hopeful that people will have enough common sense in both parties to sit down and negotiate like a Jimmy Carter would negotiate.
And
listen to each other.
And
listen to each other.
Understand, as you said, policy. I learned from a wonderful guy who's since passed just recently that it may seem great today, but before you enact it, think down the road a couple of years. Because is it knee-jerk to solve a singular problem now that could mushroom into many problems? And I never, before we have to go, I don't know if you saw this, and I don't know if I, did you see this picture and the story in the Globe?
I can't see it.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it's.
But what is the picture of?
The presidents.
And oh, the five presidents.
Yeah, it said he never accepted their code. Jimmy Carter.
Take a look at the picture again. You have four presidents sort of standing together. Jimmy Carter's on the end. On the end, and not paying attention to what they say because he felt he had a responsibility to speak out on issues, even if it could be considered critical of what an incumbent president was doing. They all had a pact that when they left the presidency, they were insulated from criticism from other presidents. Well, America doesn't get a fair shake on that when they have a Bill Clinton wouldn't be allowed to say something about the invasion of Afghanistan by W, Jimmy Carter couldn't criticize Donald Trump or any of his predecessors. I mean, when I was treasurer of the Democratic Party after I was chief of protocol and then chairman of the 1980 campaign, the very first thing the president said to me when we had started to raise money was, I want you to pay off Hubert Humphrey and Robert F. Kennedy's debt. They had a large debt that the DNC paid. It's like a mortgage. He said, you raise the money. Now, that was the hardest thing I had to do, was going around the country saying, give me money to pay off somebody else's debt. The only one who didn't have any debt was the one everybody thought was too liberal and a big spender, was George McGovern. He had no debt. He raised $32 million and he spent $32 million. Now, think about that $32 million. You can't win a congressional seat today for $32 million.
As we're coming to a close, I just want to say I'm grateful for the Jimmy Carters and the people like that and you folks that were part of that administration, part of that era. You know, it's like everybody's jumping up and down that they tore the GE down. People should sit down for a minute and think what the GE meant to this town, to this city, to this county, before they celebrate too heartily. That's just me. I can't thank you both enough for giving up your time. And I had 100 more questions. If you don't mind, I'll send them to you. You can answer them in writing. No, I'm only kidding. I think the world of both of you. And can I say this? We are both, all of us, the Polish princess, myself, Kit and Evan, are now most important job we've ever had. We're grandparents.
That's right.
That comes ahead of everything. Trust me.
We have little Presley is almost 6 months old, 5 months old.
Yeah.
Chris, and the little Hayes is just over two.
Well, our William is 24 months, and our little Ronan is 8 months.
There you go.
So that's how we spend our summer vacation.
So we have lots to celebrate.
We do. God bless. I say this. I know it accepts some of you, but God bless. And today, try to lift somebody's burden. Mm-hmm. Try to put a smile on somebody's face. You know, we're all in this together. We really are. Let's help each other.
That would be a message Jimmy Carter appreciates.
Well, I thank you for that. That means a great deal to me. And so do the both of you. We'll be in touch. Be well. Thanks.
You too. You too. Thank you.
Take care. Thank you all for listening.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Bye-bye, everybody.